Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Toby Marshall, a journalist who's been touring the Fukushima facilities and doing investigative reporting over there. Toby, welcome.
Hi. Glad to be here.
You've had the ability to go to the site to ask questions. You mentioned that there's things are really not going well over there. What can you tell us, sir?
Well, we just finished a documentary. I'm actually a cameraman, but I'm along for all of the interviews, and I've been studying this for almost 3 years since the whole thing started. And essentially, we had Prime Minister Shinzo Abe saying at, I believe in November, for the selection for the Olympics, he said, "Let me assure you, everything is under control." Well, what we're finding out is that really nothing is under control. And this is not, though, how can I put this? This is not a doomsday thing. What we're seeing is a lot of small-scale leakage, and we're seeing increasing radioactive levels in some of the wells in Fukushima, which is not a very good sign because it indicates that something is not working somewhere. I just wanted to say that we've been seeing in the last couple of months a lot of really heavy scare articles in the media, which I like to call disaster porn. And I'd like to first assure your readers that actually the levels now in the United States on the West Coast are not anything to worry about. But this is not the whole story. Things are not under control. I wrote to a friend today that we're living with a very, very fragile equilibrium. There's a huge amount of radiation that's sitting now in tanks. It's not contained, not secure. And while it's mostly being kind of held back by tanks, by other things, anything could actually cause a much bigger leak, which would be a much more problematic thing for everybody, but particularly for the people of Japan.
Now, we've heard stories about the cleanup effort going to the low bidder and people who are almost collected off the streets are doing the cleanup.
They're not almost collected. They are collected off the streets. They're literally collected off the streets. We spoke to one informant who worked for the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, and they're completely involved in this. And, of course, it's actually to the advantage of the powers that be to continue this, because while they claim that they don't want it, on the other hand, these are expendable people. And as one of the priests who is working with them there points out, these are homeless people. They're being paid something between $50 and $80 a day. They're supposed to get hazard pay. The hazard pay is being collected by their bosses, and these are people that nobody cares about. Quite honestly, everybody knows 10 years down the line they get cancer. They're just going to crawl into a corner somewhere and die. Nobody's going to bring any suits. So it's a very sad situation. Essentially, they are out of one of the really big concerns of many of the people that we spoke to is they're out of qualified people. Most of the engineers and most of the people who really understand the plant have reached their lifetime limit of radiation, and they're sending in less and less qualified people every day. So this is a continuing and will be a growing problem over the next few decades, actually, at least.
Now we've also heard, of course, of the recent earthquakes out there, and we'd heard earlier that the tanks were kind of hobbled together from pieces, that they were existing tanks that were recycled, that really these are not ideal storage facilities that are leak-proof.
No, they're not. And in fact, this is one of the really major concerns that everyone has. At first, TEPCO was trying to save money, and they were trying to get these things assembled quickly because, to be honest, they have much more water there than they know what to do with. and it's collecting very quickly. So the background to that is the plan was they have a system called ALPS, which is supposed to take out all of the, I believe, all of the radionuclides except for tritium, and it's just not been working. So what they've counted on to get this water decontaminated and then so that they can release it, this is not working. So they're continually, they're getting 300 or 400 liters a day more because groundwater is leaking into the basements. So they've essentially, they're nearly run out of space actually on the site to store tanks. But what they did originally was that they bought very cheap tanks. These are bolted tanks with very, very bad seals. And these things are just aren't up to the task. We've seen a lot of a video of these things with rusting bolts. Now you have to understand that these tanks had a projected life of 2 to 5 years. And it's they already, after 1 year, they started leaking. So what TEPCO is doing now is they're replacing all of the bolted tanks with welded tanks, which is what it should have been in the first place. But even the welded tanks, if you see pictures of the site, it's pipes running everywhere. And essentially, one big earthquake could break pipes, could break tanks. And we have very highly contaminated water in many of these tanks. And if that escapes, then that's going to definitely go into the ocean. There's no way around it. So everybody's hoping that TEPCO knows what they're doing, but nobody is very confident of that. And TEPCO has a track record of trying the cheap solution for everything. I don't know if you remember, about a year ago, they had built some underground tanks which were leaking, and it was revealed afterwards that all they did was dig a pit and line it with two layers of vinyl, and this for very radioactive water. And they said, well, we didn't think it would leak. So it's quite, you know, this is the thing that mystifies me, is why, well, it doesn't mystify me, I know why, but essentially what should happen is the Japanese government, with an international consortium of experts, should go in there and take over, because they've got the fox guarding the hen house here. TEPCO's interest is in trying to get solvent again, which is going to be very difficult. They're cutting every cost corner they can, and the government is standing back and saying, okay, you take care of it, go ahead, okay. And it's completely crazy, to be honest.
Let me ask you this. We recently heard stories about you know, they were going to try to start collecting the fuel rods. We heard that some material collapsed into the containment vessels that's going to make this unloading of the fuel rods and dealing with the interiors much more complicated. Did you get any wind of that?
Yeah, actually, I believe that is one of the lesser concerns insofar as concerns are present. Essentially, they've got, I had a friend who went in there just recently. The number three fuel pool is still a huge problem. The number four, which contains the fresh rods that are actually the most dangerous, the ones that were in the reactor in which they had pulled out, so they're the most active, has been set up. What essentially, I don't know if you know, but just recap that there was an explosion in number four, which completely destroyed the crane, which is used to lift these fuel assemblies out. Essentially, it's like an eye and a hook. All the assemblies have a little eye on them, and sure, then they've got a hook. And the crane is gone, and so they spent now the last 2 years rebuilding something that will work. And there was a lot of concern because essentially the original crane had all of the positions of these fuel assemblies in computer memory to the millimeter. And so this is kind of like a, now it's kind of like a crane game in the, you know, in the amusement park.
Right, right, to try to pick up the hole, yeah.
You got to, and they've even had to, because they're not sure that all of them are even have the eyes left, so they've created some jerry-rigged kind of pliers that they can use to try to grab the fuel rods. Now, as far as I know, so far, things have been going well. They've managed to get out a number of these and get them into the common fuel pool on the ground, which is the goal, is to get them out of that fifth floor. But of course, no one really knows how many of the rods are damaged. They did find some that are damaged. There is some video of that on the TEPCO website. There are some cracked fuel assemblies. So there is going to be, down the road, there's going to be problems, I believe, getting out some of these 1,533 assemblies that are in this fuel pool. But I would like to say that I was quite concerned, because I saw a lot of articles about possibilities of recriticality and fuel pool fires and many other things. As far as I can make out from what I consider to be credible sources, there is really no danger of this, because the decay heat it's been long enough that the decay heat is low enough that even if these fuel rods were exposed, they wouldn't burn. Basically, what happens if they're too hot, the alloy that's used as the jacket on the outside of the pellets will catch fire. It's a zirconium alloy. And this stuff burns very hot. This apparently will not happen. And the idea that a recriticality could happen with removing these rods is pretty far-fetched, because you really need to set up quite it's a very, very critical distance to get a criticality. The conditions have to be just right, and it's very hard to maintain even in an operating reactor. So the off chance, the one in a million chance that the rods could be just at the right distance to create a criticality, this is probably not a real concern. But this doesn't change the seriousness of the whole procedure, because the building is seismically been rated at zero by some people, although TEPCO claims that it can withstand another earthquake of the magnitude that struck in 2011. But if the fuel pool cracks, if these rods are exposed, essentially what happens is nobody can get anywhere near them. And it's not going to be an airborne release, but of course what's going to happen is that there's going to be the massive, massive water contamination if these things are exposed or on the ground. And it's not going to be a pretty thing.
Is that underground ice wall still in play, or have they abandoned that?
Yes,
idea?
It is. It is. In fact, we had a long talk with a man who was on a committee by the name of Mabuchi, who's one of the big politicians in Japan, and he's quite pissed off, to say the least, because the suggestion was immediately afterwards, everybody knew that this was going to be a problem with groundwater, because essentially you have to understand that Fukushima sits on what used to be a river. So there's huge underwater ground flow, water flows, and everybody knew this. And there was a suggestion immediately, we build a bentonite wall, like a clay bentonite wall, completely around the plant. And this is the only way to stop. This seemed to be the best solution. But this would have cost about $1 billion. And TEPCO was not at that time willing to do this, because they were just about to go into a shareholders meeting. And they were afraid that if they put that number into play, then all the stockholders would lose confidence and they would be forced basically into bankruptcy. So they hemmed and hawed and they pushed this completely out of play. And then, of course, we did have the problem of the groundwater. This could have been most probably solved had they built this wall in the beginning. But it's a whole question of money for them. So the ice wall, interesting, a very interesting thing we found out doing this documentary, the ice wall is considered an experimental technology. And because it's an experimental technology, TEPCO can get the government to pay for it. The government will pay for experimental technologies, but not for construction of, let's say, established technologies. So the ice wall solution was one of expedience more than anything else. And honestly, nobody knows if it's going to work. A number of experts we've spoken to have said, no, it's not going to work. And in the meantime, it's going to take a couple more years, even though they've started construction on it. So once again, it's the, how do I say it? It's the putting a precedence of profit and actually keeping things quiet over protecting people and their lives. And this is, of course, inexcusable in my opinion.
Let me ask you this. Now, you mentioned there's an underground river. That's one of the reasons why there's so much water pressure flowing past the facility into the Pacific, I presume.
Yes.
Prevailing winds. Does prevailing winds blow toward over Japan, across the other sea, toward the mainland, or are they really offshore Japan?
This is very complicated. It changes with the season. It changes with the day, with the weather. Different atmospheric levels have different winds. You can have one level where winds are blowing in one direction, and you go up a couple hundred or 1,000 meters, and they're blowing in a complete opposite direction. So it's very hard to say, but it should be noted, I think, that actually there's not much being released into the air these days. This was a major problem in the beginning when everything was so hot. Now we're at a point where, even though there has been some reports of steam coming out of, I think, three, the airborne releases are actually quite small now. So this is not something that really makes a difference in terms of the spread of radiation. Now we're dealing with water contamination, and we're dealing with the movement of the radionuclides that have been spread all over by the earlier airborne contamination in 2011.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the snow. There's been a lot of precipitation in Japan recently.
Right.
Is there reporting on a burden of radioactive material in the snow?
Yeah, I don't think that. Well, certainly there will be some in the snow, but I don't think that this is the major problem. Although I have to say that we just spoke to a hydrologist who has been studying the deposition of radionuclides coming out of the Abukuma River, which is the main river that flows through Fukushima, and huge amounts of cesium, particularly, are being washed down from the hills, from the land, into the river, into the river mouth, into the river basin, and out into the sea. And what he said is, if you look at the flows, that more than 60% have been deposited only during a couple of very heavy typhoon periods. And so any increased water flows appear to be cause for concern in terms of washing these radionuclides out into the sea. So there is a possibility that this latest huge snow, we have it here in Tokyo as well, is going to wash a huge amount of this stuff, which is actually, it's everywhere in the area. You know, it's spread throughout the land. What happens is it gets concentrated as the water washes it down into low areas. So, the snow could have an effect, although I don't think that the snow itself on the surface is necessarily heavily contaminated, although it could be in some places as well.
Let me ask you another question. Last time we spoke, and this was some time ago, you talked about how when they were concerned about the radiation impacting the topsoil, that throughout the local villages, the soil was scraped together and put into big mounds, but nothing was done with that. Are those mounds still existent? Was there dust still blowing around off of those those topsoil mounds?
Well, there is. Of course, there is, because the problem is that the decontamination takes place. They can't decontaminate. Fukushima is heavily forested mountains with occasional settlements. And so essentially what they're decontaminating is all the areas within 20 meters of human habitation, which leaves a huge amount of stuff in the mountains. The soil that they have taken, this is, of course, another huge problem that's completely unaddressed, because they've got it in bags. They put it in big bags. They build mountains of these bags everywhere, and they're still searching for a final solution for where to put these things. In the meantime, these bags also have a useful life of 2 or 3 years, and it's going to soon come to the point where these bags are breaking. Now, of course, it has to be understood that the concentration of radioactivity in these bags is not high like it is in the water. I mean, we're looking at 50 times normal. You know, it's at most, some of it is quite low actually, but it is all contaminated waste, and it should all be centralized. There was talk of using one of the abandoned villages, actually Futaba, which I just visited, which is not going to see any habitation for the foreseeable future. They said, why don't we just take all of the stuff and we dump it in this village? But of course, the people are saying, how can you do that? I mean, you're just going to, we're already had our land taken away, but we're hoping that our next generation can come back. And if you put this stuff there, then, you know, so it's a big problem. It's a big bureaucratic problem to know how to deal with this, because it's a tremendous amount of soil. I mean, they took away 5 centimeters of topsoil, and you can imagine, you know, when you're taking away hundreds and hundreds of cubic meters of this soil and putting it in bags, you have mountains of this stuff all over the prefecture. So
we've been talking about kind of the technical issues. Let me ask you about the people. You know, we've heard some stories that basically they were relocated, but not without a lot of resources. Is there economic compensation? Are they being helped for livelihoods? How is that going, or is that outside your area?
No, we've been dealing with this, and this is actually the thing that makes me feel the strongest. I mean, I believe I don't know the figures, but there's several hundred thousand people that are directly impacted by this. And there's very, very nasty stories circulating how they're trying to force the people back into quite heavily radioactive areas so that they can stop compensating them. And there's still people. People are out of the evacuation centers for the most part. But there's many, many in tiny temporary houses, which look almost like internment camps. And, of course, the problem is that these people don't have any work. And it's not that TEPCO is compensating them to any great extent. They are getting something, but it's not much. And the bureaucracy surrounding the disbursement of these funds is apparently staggering. It's no fun at all. You know, just going down to have your driver's license renewed, you know how much trouble that is. And these people have to be filing just hundreds of papers. And it's really quite a nasty situation. And that's the thing for me. We follow some of these people. We went with the former mayor of Futaba back when he went to visit his house for the first time for this documentary. And, you know, you're so struck with these people, their impotence. They can't do anything. You know, they're grist for the mill. It's a terrible thing to see. And you know, I have to say that they're very patient. But you can, and the other thing, though, I must admit, is that I'm feeling more and more anger, and not only from the common people, but from the politicians. Some of the people we spoke to were very outspoken. Some of the scientists we spoke to were very outspoken, because they feel, you know, this is all being covered up. You heard about the state secrets law that was passed.
No, go ahead. Give us a thumbnail on that.
Well, it gets rather complicated because what you've got now is a very right-wing government in there, very nationalist government. Abe, his grandfather, was actually one of the, let's say, one of the culprits of World War II, so to speak. And he's trying to, Kishi, prime minister just after the war, and he's trying to rehabilitate his grandfather. So this is one of the reasons he went to visit Yasukuni Shrine, which enraged South Korea and China and even America. They're pushing for patriotic education in the schools, more military. Partly this is due, I must say, to the rise of China and the whole conflict on the Senkaku Diaoyu Island issue. So Japan is looking and saying, "Oh, we better get it together here because we've got this huge giant on our doorstep." So unfortunately, this plays into the fears of the Japanese, and part of the so I would say that the normal Japanese, they don't want to rearm, and yet there's a growing feeling that they have to do something because China's on their doorstep. And so Abe got a lot of support for many of his kind of, let's call them, nationalist issues. And at the same time, part of his agenda is cozying up to business, of course. And it is expensive. Fossil fuels are expensive. And the Japanese, well, the nuclear village is too strong. They're trying to do a lot more alternative energy, but at the same time, then politically, they're kind of stabbing it in the back by not agreeing to feed-in tariffs. And so all of a sudden, it's no longer even economically viable for the research to go on. And so it's a messy situation. In the meantime, Abe had decided, and this has been on the table for a long time, but the more liberal governments just shelved it. But he rammed through the state secrets law, which is something really that would make China proud, because it mandates quite severe jail sentences for what they consider to be the revelation of state secrets by journalists, for instance, or other people. But they don't even specify what a state secret is. They don't define it. And well, so you've got a situation. It's perfect for them because it basically keeps everybody feeling like, oh, well, I better not say anything, because if it turns out that they think it's a state secret, then they're going to throw me in jail for 5 years. I have to say, though, that, you know, I believe, honestly, that this is going to backfire. Ultimately, I don't think they're going to pass it. There's now a challenge in the court. One brave lawyer has decided he's going to challenge the whole thing. And the Japanese, unfortunately, are not very proactive individually. But if they get some people initiating some of these things, then hopefully we will see this not going where Abe hopes it will go.
Well, we see in American press that Abe the new mayor of Tokyo is considered very, very pro-nuke.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, he's hiding that. He's not, you know, the thing is that actually the anti-nuke movement here in Japan was very strong for a while, and it scared them. And what they've managed to do is they've relentlessly pushed it down. But it's quiet now, so to speak. But it could reignite in a heartbeat if something happened. This is one of the reasons I believe that they're keeping things so mum about the reality of Fukushima, because they know that if they really let people know how bad the situation is, that it could in a moment, you know, this whole anti-nuke movement could reignite and give them a lot of trouble. So it's been a hard struggle for them to keep it down, and they've managed to do it through use of fear about the military, through the big one is, of course, the businesses are all saying, oh, we'll sink under the waves, you know, we're just coming out of our two decades long economic recession, but if we have to keep paying for these new fossil fuels, you know, we will be completely uncompetitive, all of the businesses will have to move out of Japan, we'll sink. So they've scared everybody with this. Just on the other side, though, we spoke to a Kono, who's a member of parliament. His father was a foreign minister, I believe. He's quite highly placed. And even though he's in the ruling party, he's very, very anti-nuke. And he says that actually it's complete bullshit, that this is just an excuse, that Japan could function absolutely fine without ever starting another nuclear plant. But they're using the economic excuse because, of course, the amount of money that is being lost every day by the utilities, you know, these nuke plants, many of them are paid for. So it's pure profit for these guys. And now all of a sudden they have to import it, you know, Somebody's pocket is not getting lined the same way. So they're trying their best. They're trying their best. But it's very difficult because now people are very wary. And they've had to keep very quiet about the fact that the earthquakes, more than the tsunami, the earthquake seems to have caused many of the problems in Fukushima. And if this comes out in any major way, then it really means it's going to be years before they can start even one, if they can ever start one. And I have to say that the IAEA is in bed with them, because they're also, you know, they have the dual function of
promoting, yeah,
and promoting. And when they came over here, just after the, I forget the man's name who was in charge. I wish I knew it now. It's not coming to me. But anyway, he made a statement immediately saying all the problems were caused by the tsunami. There was no damage by earthquake. But we found out quite differently, speaking to both workers and scientists. At least this seems to be the case, although it's very hard to get really real proof of this. But it certainly seems to be that the earthquakes were a major, major factor by scientific consensus, because of pressure temperature data, which was hidden for a long time by TEPCO. That, you know, for instance, the pressure rose and then all of a sudden it leveled off, and they shouldn't have done that. And the only explanation that anybody has is, oh, well, all the pipes must have broken. So all the steam pressure was leaking out anyway. And of course, this, not only steam pressure, but then the hydrogen was leaking out. And this is maybe what caused the explosions. So, you know, the tsunami is a very handy scapegoat for what happened there. But it really looks like the tsunami maybe only added insult to injury, at least in one or two of those three.
You know, everything you said has been so insightful, and I can't thank you enough, but I got to express one little bit of, I'm going to say, absolute shock and amazement. You know, you said that, you know, the anti-nuke movement is quiescent because they're, that, you know, if something could happen that would, you know, make them really step up. And I got to tell you, that sounds absolutely shocking, because if Fukushima's ongoing problems isn't, you know, the fire alarm, I'm, you know, what's it going to take?
Well, but the thing you have to understand is that the Japanese have been essentially conditioned. Well, there's a Japanese characteristic, which is you try not to say too much, you know, unless, you know, you listen to the authorities. They've got it really, really artfully under control. Let me put it that way. But again, to my mind, it's very much like the entire political situation in China, which is, I live in China half the year, and you know, you don't know this, but for instance, just to change the subject slightly, I'll bring it back in a second.
Sure.
The number of what they call serious social incidents. This would be riots and other such things, increased between 2009 and 2011. They doubled from 89,000 to 190,000 in 1 year. And there's good reason that the Chinese are as repressive and authoritarian as they are, because they're sitting on a tremendous pressure cooker. it's kind of like dry tinder, you know, during the fire season, one spark. And so this is one of the reasons that they're so on top of everything. And I think that the Japanese, they can't be as authoritarian as the Chinese. It's not within their culture or their history, their recent history anyway. But they have used every tactic possible to say everything is under control, you know, to divert your attention from this. We spoke to one scientist who was threatened because he was coming out telling the data that he was finding out. And they told him, we don't want you to appear on TV anymore. And he was literally threatened. He gave us an interview, but only from the back, no face, and disguising his voice so that he can't be recognized. And what he said was pretty shocking. I mean, it's so much worse than anybody is letting on. And the problem is, in the West, what you've got is you've got people who are, it's hysteria. I'm sorry, but it's hysteria to a great extent. I just had a friend write me from Hawaii who said, there's these YouTube channels and everybody in Hawaii is panicking. They think now that maybe they have to move to the Southern Hemisphere. You know, can you give me some insight? And I had to say, you know, this is the fear mongering is not the answer. It's not the answer. What we need is good information, because otherwise, essentially, my feeling is that I understand the wish to make it appear really, really bad so that it will mobilize people to say, OK, we've got to stop nuclear energy. I'm completely for stopping nuclear energy. But the problem is that if we people who are opposed to nuclear energy are completely running around like hysterical chickens, spouting a bunch of nonsense, it discredits us. And this is why I think it's so important to really try to get accurate information and use that, because only with the truth are we going to be able to do anything. I mean, if we pander to fear like they pander to fear, they're going to win because they're more powerful. So hopefully the truth is going to be the thing that mobilizes action away from this ridiculous way of generating energy. I'm sorry, the danger is, you know, this is another thing I just wanted to say is that we were very lucky with Fukushima. People think I'm crazy when I say that, but there are one of the scientists told us that the estimates is that there are 60 etabecquerels of radiation contained in Fukushima. And that's 60 with 18 zeros after it. That's the amount of radiation, which is, and this is only in five plants out of how many are in the world? 440, I believe. And so you see, it's like the amount of lethal material that's being held is beyond my conception. I can't even begin to think about it. So what's being released from Fukushima is several petabecquerels altogether, which is a huge amount, but the world is big. And except for hotspots, this stuff will spread out. And so it's not going to be as lethal. Of course, no radiation is good, but the sky is not falling. Let me put it that way.
Let me ask you one other question. And I so appreciate your time, Toby. And, you know, no talking problem. To you we're getting it right from the horse's mouth. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. The one question is there an international presence on site, or is it totally under TEPCO?
It's totally under TEPCO. There may be a small international presence. TEPCO did agree to an international presence, but I have not heard anything about it since hearing that there was an agreement that they would allow people in there. Even the government is essentially not in there. Everything is under TEPCO. And this is, again, something that is beyond my understanding, because TEPCO's track record has been so poor. They've been caught lying so many times. It's been so clear. There are leaked documents showing conspiracies on their part not to reveal information, to try to divert information. I mean, how can one not do this? I think the only explanation is that the power companies, in one very real way, they run Japan. They provide 60 to 70% of the advertising budgets for the media, for all the TV. They pay the governors, they pay everything. The government then, on the other hand, is in charge of all the research. And of course, there's business and government collusion up the gazoo, as there is everywhere. But the problem is there's no independent research. We spoke to some scientists who told us that if they published anything that was unpopular, that they would just not get funded anymore. And so they have to tread very carefully. These are committed people who do want to bring the truth out, but they're having a lot of trouble doing it, because when their conclusions are not what the government wants to hear, then they know that they are putting themselves and maybe their entire institution on the line, because funding will be cut off. And there's no talk about that. That's just the way it is. You know, you can't, there's no court you can bring that to. So it's a difficult situation, made worse by the fact that the power structure as it is, you know, is as it is. And so, as I say, we are trying, my television company, I work for German television, and luckily in Germany there's a political opening for being critical, and you know, there's the commitment still in Germany to stop nuclear, although the business people are screaming about this, to stop all nuclear by 2022. So we have more of a free hand than the American networks, for instance, which I'm sorry to say, but it's a big business in America, and you know, they don't want you to think that maybe that's not such a good idea.
Let me ask you one last question, if I may, sir.
Sure.
And again, I so appreciate your indulgence.
No problems.
We hear stories about thyroid issues in the children in the area.
Yeah.
And radiation scientists typically warn us that pregnant women are also in extra danger. Have you heard anything, or have you covered any of the stories about the children?
One of the people we covered in our documentary was a woman who's they do thyroid screenings, and they divide them into four categories. There's A1, A2, B, and C. A1 is no problem at all. A2 is a very small nodule or cyst, I don't remember, of up to 5 millimeters, I think. B is between 5 and 20, and C is you better be checked again, because this looks either cancerous or precancerous. And we spoke to a woman whose son was diagnosed C, and she thinks that it's because he played in an area where it was very, very highly, we measured it at over six microsieverts per hour, which is, let's say, about 60 times the normal. And It's a question. It's a real interesting conundrum, because normally thyroid abnormalities don't show up till 4 to 5 years. At least this was what they say was the what they saw in Chernobyl.
Conventional wisdom, yeah.
Yeah, and we did. There was, as you say, there was a lot of abnormalities, more than most people expected, in terms of these cysts and nodules, which are fairly normal as you age, but it's unusual to see them in children. And they did do some cross-area studies, because we asked them, we said, okay, you're finding now 42% of the children have some sort of thyroid abnormality in the area. So have you checked in Kyushu? Have you checked in Osaka? I mean, have you gone up to Hokkaido? Are you checking all the kids? And the studies that we heard is that there are more thyroid abnormalities in Japan than seem to be present in other areas. I don't have exact figures, and I hesitate to make any kind of authoritative statements, but They think this may have to do with the diet intake of kelp, which is full of iodine, la la la. So essentially, I think that this is inconclusive. But you do have some, the idiocy is beyond belief. The man in charge, the doctor in charge of the Fukushima Health, Dr. Yamashita, is famous. He's on YouTube. You can find it. He gave a talk in which he said, and I quote, "If you smile, you don't get sick from radiation. If you're worried, you get sick." We proved this, he said. We proved this with animal studies. And this immediately brought to my mind, oh, so you made the animals smile and they didn't get cancer, and you made them worried and they did. Excuse me, you proved this with animal studies. And it's almost beyond belief for an American, but somehow the Japanese nodded and said, okay, now we're happy. Apparently, you know, the big authority said it's fine. I mean, not everybody. But this is one of the things that's very frustrating about Japan as compared to America. And there's many things I love about Japan, but this passivity in the face of any kind of uncomfortable, let's say, need to be proactive, this is not nice. It's, I guess, a historical fact which keeps haunting the Japanese. But there it is. And so, but I have to say as well that there's a great thirst for knowledge. They want to know. Our last documentary was watched over a million times in Japan, and we had many people telling us that they thanked us because they said this was the information that they knew they were not getting. They know they're not getting correct information, but they don't know where to go for correct information, and this is the biggest problem. Everybody's got an agenda. So,
well, Toby, thank you so very much for your time, sir.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad to try to, you know, I'm not an expert, and what I'm telling you is my impressions. There are places I would like to suggest that FukuLeaks, www.fukuleaks.org, seems to be, to my mind, a very, very good place to get, let's say, rational and seemingly good information on the status in Fukushima. It's one of the only sites that I've found, and I just leave that with you as something that you can keep an eye on.
Well, thank you again, sir, and we sure appreciate it. Toby, you have a wonderful night and get some rest, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rick, and let's just keep trying to push through all this darkness and try to get to the end of the tunnel. It's not going to be easy, but has to be done. It's just so clear now that we can't be passive and just let this kind of thing happen. We have to find the way to be active and bring the truth of what's going on out. And then I have to say, just as a closing thing.
Sure, sure.
I think what is clear is that nuclear energy is very convenient in many ways. Not when you look at the overall, but at least at the moment, we've got so many eggs in the nuclear basket that it'd be very difficult to switch out of that immediately. And what I like is, in a democratic situation, is to bring all the information to people about the risks and the benefits, and say, you decide, what risk do you want for what benefit? And I think that's the way to do it. If people make the decision that nuclear is better than mass starvation or economic hardship or whatever it is, that's fine. But the main point is that people have to have correct information to make correct decisions. And that's what we have to try to do, get out the correct information.
Well, you know, you make an excellent point about the fact that, unfortunately, science doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists typically in a corporate or governmental framed box. And
yes,
unfortunately, science and corporations really don't mix very well.
That's very true, and that's one of the big problems that I think we have to address in our society, because the science has been co-opted now, and it's no longer a pure, let's say, a pure search for knowledge. It's being bent to somebody's needs or their wishes, and this is dangerous.
Thank you so very much, sir. You have a good evening.
Okay, Rick, thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you again, hopefully.
Okay.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.